Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Good music is good music, and it could exist and thrive in any climate.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 157, a talk with Nice and Smooth. Greg Nice and Smooth B came together to form a group in 1986, a decision they're now celebrating with a 30th anniversary tour. Even back then, the Bronx duo already had music business experience. Greg beatboxing for Tila Rock, and Smooth writing raps for Bobby Brown. But when they joined forces, things really took off. Their self-titled 1989 debut album and its 1991 follow-up Ain't a Damn Thing Changed are generally regarded as classics and spawned hits like Funky for You, Hip Hop Junkies, and of course, Sometimes I Rhyme Slow. They also made several now immortal guest appearances with artists like Big Daddy Kane and Gangstar. Make sure to stay tuned all the way to the end credits of the show to find out how you can hear a bonus story from Smooth B that he told us after the end of the interview. We talked to Nice and Smooth at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, make sure to listen to our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with a member of another great rap duo, No Malice of Clips fame, on episode 78. Also, consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the group that still can't quite make up their mind about whether they're rhyming slow or quick, Nice and Smooth. You know, you guys met my producer, Josh, and Greg, he wanted you to know specifically that he did wash today.
Oh, you're funny. I'm like, what the hell is he talking about? Oh, snap. That's crazy. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. How did you... So for people who are listening, this is a group called The Nasty Comedians that you didn't rap for, but beatboxed with.
Right.
How did you get hooked up with that? That was like 85, 86, somewhere around there?
It had to be 84, right? Yeah, it had to be 84. Yeah. You know, we're all from the same neighborhood. New York streets. That's what made New York, New York. That's why there's a new New York right now. Everything is so kind of like segregated in a way. You know, I'm from this crew. I don't mess with that crew. You know, we basically all knew each other in the neighborhoods back then.
Right. And you did a lot of shows with people also, even with groups we might not think that you were associated with, Cover Girls and that kind of stuff. Was that was a beatboxer too?
Yeah. Yep. All of that. I mean, I was doing that from like 83 on to now.
How did you first get into beatboxing?
I mean, it was the new thing in the neighborhood. It was rare. It was a handful of people you could name on one hand that was really doing that. And that's when block parties were really happening, which they don't have today.
Right.
They don't do block parties no more because I guess the unity is not the same. The economy is not the same. People were more like bonded like family. Even if you didn't have anything, even if you lived in a building, a tenement building here in Harlem or in Brooklyn or the Bronx or whatever, you know, you can live on one floor and the next floor, the apartment is burnt out. Everybody was more like a family and you doing something wrong, somebody else's parents will spank you and call your parents, and then they'll spank you, you know. So it was a whole lot of different things happening. That's what made it so, like, I guess unified. And it was the thing to do, man. I was blessed with that talent to be able to do that, and I ran with it.
Yeah, and your first, even before you guys got together, your first sort of taste of real success was with T. LaRock. You did a lot. You were on, your name was on his album cover. You even had your own featured solo song on his album.
Yeah. That was a plus. I know where my blessings came in, and I know what it meant to want to conquer that stage. So getting to this point in my life, my career, it showed me how to be a man and how to respect people and don't take it for granted, because this is something that you prayed and wished for, and finally you had it. And, you know, some people get that and they lose their mind.
So how did you feel when you first looked at that T. LaRock album cover and you saw it said featuring Greg Nice?
It was a great feeling. I mean, I'll never forget it. It made me feel good, you know. I knew it was more things to come, though. I definitely knew it was more things to come.
One more thing about that era is a couple of the things T. LaRock did were with Curtis from Mantronix.
Curtis Khalil, a.k.a. Curtis Mantronix, is a producer best known for his work as half of the duo Mantronix with MCT. The group's 1985 full-length debut, The Album, made use of then-new technology like the Roland TR-808 drum machine and MIDI to help define the sound of electro-funk.
What was, he's kind of maybe overlooked a bit when it comes to hip-hop producers, I think. What was he like? Did you get to work with him one-on-one? Or
a lot. He's amazing. He is my inspiration to create music with machines. I learned a lot from being around him, watching him. I'm happy to say that I see all of the people that have came and went and that's here today, and he's exceptional because, one, he did it without a blueprint. These people today have a blueprint. They got things that they can go look at, video footage of this, and I'm going to do this like that. And a lot of the machine companies like Korg and all of that, they shit sucked. All of they stuff sucked. And a lot of the sounds and things that's in these programs today come from shit that he created. Like, they sampled things from these guys' records and made them shit sounds that's in your Fruity Loops and in your Pro Tools and all of that shit. So before, you had to know how to mix a record. You had to know how to EQ sounds and to create sounds. So at the time, he's incredible. Now, I imagine if he's doing it right now with any of the equipment that they use and stuff today, he'd probably be out of here, you know. And today, a lot of it is repetitious. I got the same sound module. You got the same sound module. So as soon as your damn beat come on, I already know it's the same goddamn shit. He's a great producer. He ain't great. I could do the same shit. It's in the same module I got. You're great, like, even like when bands and everything were happening, you know, that's when that engineer was really important. And the way they would mix a record, if I'm hitting a snare on the drum, it may go, but the way this guy EQs it, he make it, everybody had their own. It doesn't have that now. Everything's so, I got the 1808 kick snare. It's already EQ'd. Everybody has it the same way. And Curtis, man, I know how people bug out on me, and I'm like, man, I learned from that guy. He's crazy.
And he had someone helping him out. You can tell me what he was doing. I don't know if it was, you know, editing or helping with tape machines or what. But
editing, yes.
Robert from CNC Music Factory.
Rob used to work in the mailroom, if I'm not mistaken, in Stockholm. Rob used to work there. And that was an inspiration to Rob, looking at Curtis. That's what that was. So nobody could fuck around. It was only like Curtis and Rick Rubin and Dave Ogren and Arthur Baker and them dudes. They was the shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And Smooth, you know, your beginning of your career, the first time that your name was set on record, the first time your voice appeared on record was the first Bobby Brown album, right?
Yeah.
King of Stage?
Absolutely, yeah.
So he's a Boston guy. How did you meet him?
It was interesting, you know. At that time, I was working as a messenger in New York. And the craziest thing is, maybe it's funny how they, you know, you hear about different things and you hear 6 degrees of separation, you know, whatever, or how things just line up sometime. But let's say within a 2-week time period, I had met this guy. I had met Mixmaster Ice from UTFO. And I met him through another mutual friend that I grew up with. It was doing road work with him, roadie work and what have you. And he went on the road. He used to tell us these fascinating stories about how he toured with UTFO and New Edition and all that. So it was my childhood friend. And so one day when Roxanne was out.
That's what you get. It happened to me. Ain't that right, Mixmaster ICE? Roxanne. You thought you had a rope. You thought you was...
So my boy called me up, and I had moved from the neighborhood in the South Bronx to the North Bronx. So all that to say, my boy calls me up. He says, yo, come around the old neighborhood. I came around the old neighborhood, and Mixmaster Ice, who lived in Brooklyn, came to the Bronx. And then, but then within that time period that I moved, you know, I've been gone for about like a year. So my pen game had got tight. So he was like, I heard you be rhyming now, Smooth. And I was like, yeah, you know, I got some joints. Long story short, I rhymed for Mixmaster Ice. And at that time, when someone that was hot or successful, especially within your age bracket or what have you, told you, it was a great inspiration if they told you you had it. You know what I mean? So he was like, dude, you could rhyme, man. You're going to be all right. I was like, what? So I went home and wrote about 20 more rhymes. I was like, Mixmaster Ice said I could, yeah. So I was pumped. Yeah. So like 2 weeks later, I'm walking through Midtown because I was a messenger, like I said, right? Now, the deep part about it was Mixmaster, we were talking, and I was like, we hung out for a while. I said, yo, I got to go work tomorrow, man. And he's like, yeah, what you do? I said, I'm a messenger. He said, I used to be a messenger. So now I'm really bugging. I was like, you used to be a messenger? You told me I could rhyme? Ah! So I went home and went crazy. You know what I'm saying? Now I'm just writing like a madman. So then about 2 weeks later, again, I'm doing the messenger gig. This was so crazy. So I got the package. I'm walking down the street. And it was like a rainy day like today. I did not want to leave the house. And it's something just, let me just damn go, man. I'm walking down the street, walking down 7th Avenue. I stop in this pizza shop. I look across the street. I see Mixmaster Ice standing on the corner. It was a trip. But it was on the corner of the Omni Hotel. So when I come out, yo, Max. He look like it's Smooth. He's like, yo, come here, man. I come across the street. I said, yo, what's up? He said, what you doing down here? I said, I'm a messenger, man. I told you. He's like, So we laughing. He's like, yo, that's crazy. So I said, what you doing? He said, I'm waiting for Bobby Brown, man. He's like, yeah, you know, for New Edition. He left the group. And I was like, yeah. All right, I got you. And Bobby walks out of the building, out of the hotel. So he goes. So he introduced us. He was like, yo, because they would categorize you by your borough. Yo, he a rapper from the Bronx. You know, that's what he told me. He said, yo, he a rapper from the Bronx, man. Like that, right? So Bobby was like, what? Yeah, bring him to the studio. Like that. So then, so now I'm just standing there like I'm taking all this. And he goes, bring him to the studio. So he said, yo, you want to come to the studio? I said, I'm on the clock, man. I was like, dude, I'm on the clock, man, you know? So long story short, he said, all right, look, I'm staying in the Omni. Boom, 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 boom. You need to come by, man. Come check me out. So I said, I'll come see you later on. I went by the hotel and everything. And then Mixmaster, everybody was there. But it was so crazy when I came in the hotel room. It's like everybody started walking through the hotel room. So I'm bugging. LL came. Red Alert. Eric B. I'm sitting there like, yo, what the flip? No, it wasn't Eric. It was it was Red Alert, Chuck Chill Out, and LL. Wow. Then later on, Eric B. came through.
Right.
So, but I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh shit, LL.
And you're just a teenager who just stumbled into this hotel.
Man, tell me about it.
Yeah.
So then he goes, so bust a rhyme, rhyming. And they all was looking at me like, oh, shit. And Lord, after everybody started clearing out, Bob was like, yo, anybody producing you? And I was like, nah, man. He's like, I'm going to produce you. So I was like, oh, word? Right? So boom, I said, okay, bet. So he's like, what you doing tomorrow, man? Come to the studio. So, all right. Boom, went the next day. And Dr. Ice from UTFO was writing for him at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was just how life goes. I came to the session. Dr. Ice couldn't make it.
So is the story.
I'm telling you, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
And I was sitting right there.
Always. Yeah.
And he was like, and I see Bob going through it on the phone. You know what I'm saying? And he's like, what am I going to do? You know? And I was like, what you need? He's like, you need a rhyme? Man, I got you, man. He's like, you can write for me? I said, tell me what you want to say. You know, and then that's when it was born. I started writing.
Amazing. And so is it safe to say you wrote pretty much all the rhymes on the King of Stage album?
Yes. Now tell me, baby. Could she have in store? The girl next door, her very essence, her presence, I do adore. And being this close is driving me wild. I love her personality, her style, her smile. My life.
Yeah, what about the second one?
And then the second one, Don't Be Cruel, the rap one there. Hey, cutie, what's up with the attitude? He ain't really have too many rhymes on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot. I re-listened to the first one yesterday. There's a lot of rhyming on there.
Yeah, man.
They kept you pretty busy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. He actually didn't put your name on the cover, but shouted out your name on the title track.
Yeah.
How'd you feel when that happened?
Oh, man, that was great, man. It was a great feeling, man. And he gave me my first video cameo in the song Girlfriend.
Mm.
Yeah, so I'm in that joint. You see Smooth B, 90-pound Smooth B. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But that was, and then to see it on Hot Tracks at that time, I was like, oh, shit, I'm on Hot Tracks. I made it.
Yeah.
A little bit. I'm on the way. You know what I'm saying? Those are great times, you know, because all of those times are like so inspirational.
Yeah.
But I think that if it's your calling and you really are supposed to do it, you're still filled with a hunger to do it. Like, you'll say, there's more.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And the interesting part about it was I went on a couple of tours with him and so forth and so on, and I got exposure to a lot of things. It was a great opportunity. But while I was on the road with him, oh, man, it's crazy. I meet another friend, right? I'm thinking this guy's from Texas. The whole time I'm on the road, I'm thinking he's from Texas. Till the last day of tour, everybody's about to fly back to New York. And we all coming in LaGuardia. So I'm like, yo, dude, what's up? And he was like, I live in the Bronx, man. I said, yeah. He was like, yo, I got to give, you know, take my number and all that. Take the number. And then about 2 days later, he gave me a call. I said, what's up, man? We started talking. He said, yo, I'm going to come by your spot, man. I'm going to come to your crib. I gave him my address. He came by. He said, I got somebody I want you to meet. I said, yeah? He said, I'm telling you. He said, because I've been listening. I know. This was the thing. Bobby was on some band thing.
Mm.
Back then, he was like, you're going to be the first rapper with a band. You know? I'm like, ah. So, like, sampling was starting to really, really, really get popping. So I was just like, that's up my alley. And so... So I would be going back and forth with Bob, like, nah, but listen, it's a way, man. If you sample, you got to take the sound from the records, man. People like that. You know what I'm saying? Fuck the band, replaying it. Let's think of really, you got the original band members. You know what I mean? He's like, you're going to be the first rapper with a band. So the guy, right,
yeah.
He says, and his name is Lance. He goes, I got somebody that know just, that get you. Like, trust me, when you meet him, you're going to love him, man. Trust me, like. He talked the same way, like you talk about sampling and all that. I got somebody for you. It was Greg.
And it was Greg. Yeah. Wow.
Yep.
Amazing. Yep. Amazing. And just, you know, before we get to sort of the early days of the group, one more thing about Bobby. You know, he was already a star with New Edition. He had the first album. But that second record was like megastar, right?
Yeah.
Bobby Brown's second solo album, 1988's Don't Be Cruel, made it to number one on the Billboard album chart for 6 weeks, had five top 10 singles, including the number one hit, My Prerogative, and was the best-selling album of 1989 in the United States. It has sold over 7 million copies in the U.S. alone.
What was that like for you to see someone you knew? I mean, he was famous when you met him, but to see him go from, you know, famous to, like,
superstar. It was so rewarding, and it was so inspirational. You know, like, I'm a people's person, you know what I mean? And, like, but at the same time, like, who I have love for, you know what I mean? You know, I appreciated the opportunities and all of that, but I knew where, it's like, I knew where he wanted to go. And when he told me what he was trying to do, and then I'm a part of the process, I was like, dude, I believe in you, man, because I know what it's like when someone doesn't believe in you. And I know when it seems like you're talking Martian to people. You know what I'm saying? So that's basically what was going on, because back then, it was had always been in my mind. I always wanted to fuse R&B and hip-hop. You know, hip-hop and R&B, singing melodic. That's how we grew up. And so I knew that if he got it right, you know what I'm saying? He was already, you know, and what the industry at that time was trying to do was separate the two. R&B can't do nothing with no rap. Rap can't do, you know what I mean? And I was like, nah, man. I said, if this dude, I'm going to add on, you know what I'm saying, and give him a little formula. If he could execute it, this is going to be crazy. So I saw the vision. So by the time when the second album hit, I was like, there you go, dog. There it is, you know.
Amazing. And so, you know, I wanted to ask about you guys growing up a little bit, because you're both in the Bronx.
Yeah.
And Greg, you said something about the park jams, how there used to be park jams. I know you guys used to go to them all the time, you know, Cedar Park, Echo Park, all the places that now are kind of legendary, and that, you know, as you know, they're trying to recreate on TV and all this kind of stuff. For people who weren't able to make it, what were those park jams like, and kind of when do you remember them starting to happen?
Well, me, myself, I lived all over the Bronx, and I can remember the late 70s when I was a kid. The local DJs from the neighborhood would bring their system outside, which is the turntable, the mixer, and the speakers, and the amplifier. And they used to keep a fan next to the amp because the amp would overheat and it would turn off, or they would kick the bottom of the light pole and stick a fuse in a light pole, an adapter, and you plug the cord into it, and that's how they got the power. And they would also put like a brown paper bag over a light bulb, so they have the light would be nice, you know, and have that set up on the turntable, you know, and you definitely had to come out in a jam in the evening, because in the summer, in the daytime, the heat was there, so it would have melted the vinyl. So you had to come out when the sun was going down. So that's all the time you knew when it was about to jam. It's like, yo, the sun's going down. And you'll see guys coming down the street with a dolly, with a big speaker the size of that freezer over there. You're like, oh, it's about to go down. It's about to go down. And you hear music echoing off of these tenement buildings. That's what made New York, like, amazing. And you hear the delay. Boom, 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 boom. Man, and everybody would come out and dance. They would play all kind of different beats and break beats and playing Aerosmith break beats and things to that nature. And, you know, music was so universal at that time. It wasn't like, oh, I'm green, I listen to this. I'm yellow, I listen to this. People listen to music like when we growing up, I'm listening to Hall & Oates, and we listening to everything, Motley Crue, we listened to Isley Brothers, because music was ill.
Yeah.
And no matter what genre, it was good.
And when you started producing yourself, did you find you were going back to some of those records that you'd heard park jams?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, most definitely. And and it gave me an opportunity to try other stuff. I'm like, hold on, if this could work this way, let me try this that way. You always wanted to do something different from what everybody else was doing. And if it was sounding too similar like somebody else, you'd be like, hold on, let me fix that. Wow. I got to change that. I got to go a different way.
Yeah.
Opposed to today and time. If it sounds like this person, then I'm doing the same thing as this person.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so limited. And that's why you'll have a lot of people to be like, I don't really like the music today. It kind of sucks. And then it'd be somebody that never experienced anything different. They're like, why you say it suck? You know, you're a hater. And he'd be like, no, I'm not a hater. I'm sad because you didn't get an opportunity to see other things, to know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody like they may see Dougie Fresh perform that's younger, and they're like, yo, that dude was incredible. And be like, you missed it. It was a lot of guys that was incredible. You know, you didn't get to see it. You know, it ain't your fault. You know, it's showing you how powerful that music was, because hip-hop, supposedly what they call it today, hip-hop dominates the music scene. And all of that stems from the original stuff.
Yeah. So this is something maybe both of you can answer, in that, Greg, I saw you say something once about how rapping, that word, wasn't really a word you related to at first. That was like a word reporters used on television when talking about.
Yeah, like they said, wilding. The guys was in Central Park, they were wilding.
Right.
It's like, no, we like, it's wilding.
So did you even have a word for someone, you know, rhyming over a beat? It was an MC.
MC. Mm-hmm. Master of ceremony.
Exactly.
That's what I mean. MC such and such. Yeah, that's MC da da da. MC Shadi. MC, you know, MC.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They wasn't like rapper, citizen. I'm rapper this, I'm rapper that. You know, once it became like a business, the same way I seen a clip of that new Miles Davis movie, and he was like, when he was playing Miles Davis, Don Cheadle, he's like, hey man, you guys come up here and try to change our social music, calling it jazz. This is social music.
I am not dying over this jazz tape.
Don't call it jazz, man. That's a made up word. It's social music.
I was like, oh, it's the same things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, big companies want to get involved with it, and this guy coming and exploiting it, you know.
Right.
And that's what it seems like to a lot of people, like, God, they bitter and stuff. It's like, they're not bitter. They just did things that they love from the core, and you came in and with your big money and pimped the shit out.
Right. And, you know, speaking of that kind of first generation of artists, you know, you guys growing up in the Bronx and going to clubs and stuff, knew DJ Hollywood, I'm assuming, and saw him perform.
Yeah.
Anthony DJ Hollywood Holloway is a DJ and MC who was arguably the first rapper. He began rhyming over existing instrumentals during his nightclub act as early as 1975. He is also sometimes credited with being the first person to tell a crowd, throw your hands in the air and wave them like you just don't care. We discussed DJ Hollywood with author Dan Charnas on episode 64.
He's still around. I've seen him perform, but like, he was like the biggest thing, right? In that era. For people who weren't around, and because he didn't really make records, he's not that well remembered today. Can you give us an idea like how big a star DJ Hollywood was kind of in his prime?
And his, you know, you got to understand, it was like he did the parks and he did the clubs. You know, he did the social clubs, the, you know, anywhere that you wanted to be, like, because he's a little older than us, you know what I'm saying? So it'd be like, Holly, you going to a party that Hollywood did? You know what I'm saying? That was like big time. It was classy, you know what I mean? And it was like, he had to, okay, he did the park, so he's a groundbreaking pioneer, but he would wear suits and tuxedos and all of that. And he just was bigger than life with his whole swag, you know? And it was like, you just like, yo, Hollywood. You know, it's like
they had class.
Class. You know what I'm saying? And it was like a lot of artists have class, man, and had class and displayed it. It was like, you know, when they did it in the street, it was because before the records, they made you feel like you had a connection with a star in your neighborhood. You know, that's what make what anybody that wanted to do it, that's what you wanted to bring back. You know, like you could have the stylistic story or whoever, the Rick Jameses and all of that, right? Which they were real, you know what I mean? Because you could see him and go, that's a real dude. I could relate to that. But you're not going to be in Hollywood. Like, you can only see him on TV. But you could get a chance to see DJ Hollywood, Love Bug Starsky, Curtis Blow.
Your friend Tito.
Tito.
Yeah.
Smooth B's longtime friend, Devastating Tito Dones of the Fearless Four.
Walking down the street or driving down the street or walk in the store where you live. And you're like, oh, shit, that's, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what made it a lot, you know, really special. But he's, man, come on, man. And his voice, he had the crazy voice.
Everybody clap your hands. Now I don't mean to brag or boast. I'm like the hot butter on your morning toast. I'm not a Duracell, I'm an alkaline. So let's have a good time. That's right, y'all.
Yeah. Hollywood was crazy.
Yeah.
And these people will speak to you, too.
Yeah.
You know, it ain't like, it could be an artist today, you know, you got some that's ground level, but there's some that's so caught up in the hype that they forget what it's like to be a human or to be a regular person on the street, because you dreamed and wanted to do these certain things. And then a lot of them, too, are in it for money. They don't come from the core of it. When we wanted to get down with all this, we lived with our moms and stuff. There wasn't no video channels on, and hip-hop music wasn't playing on the radio all day. It was something that you love. It was a culture. It was great. And that's why it became so big. And that's why you can go back to records 30, 40 years now and play them and go, wow, did you hear what he said? Did you hear the sound of this? And those same songs, you could take it and sample the music today and make another
hit. Yeah.
So it's that's the difference, I think, too. You know, if you don't know certain things, it ain't your fault. You just wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know?
So you guys were originally, or one of the ideas when the group was forming was that you guys were going to be a trio. You're going to be Nice, Smooth, and Love.
Yeah.
So who was June Love?
June Love was a guy from my neighborhood, and he's very talented. And I used to do the beatbox for him. And he went to high school with Slick Rick and Dana Dane and the Kango Crew. They all went to Music and Art High School here in Manhattan.
You can hear more about the Kango Crew's high school years on episode 55 with our classmates MC Search and Blake Keolitham.
And he wanted me to rap with him, and I didn't really want to rap with him. I said, I just want to do the beatbox for you. He's like, nah, but you could do it. You know, I need you to do it with me. I don't want to do it with myself. And he wrote me a rap and told me to say this part. And I'm like, okay. I did a little bit of it. And time went on. You know, I introduced him to Smooth. We hit it off, all of us, the same day. I can remember us sitting in my mom's kitchen. And we're in there talking about what we're going to do. And he always had the Madita Sambas like Josh has in the front. And he put me up on the Madita Sambas. I was like, I like that. Let me get me some of those, too. And the word they use today, his swag.
Yeah, right.
He had an original, like no other swag. Same as Smooth. Everybody had their own shit that was incredible. And that's one of the things that makes me real passionate about what we do and what about the culture. Because I got a chance to see, like, crayon box, the 64 box of crayons. One is burgundy, one is maroon, one is brown, one is rust. It was all unique but different.
Yeah.
And that's what was going on, you know. Everything, the way you dress, the way you talk. And a lot of times, dudes ain't have a lot of money. So when you're getting a woman, you had to have the gift of gab. You had to have a good personality.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be in a relationship 30 years because of love and things like that. And, you know, you had Millie Jackson, and you had Red Fox Records and Richard Pryor and all of that Blowfly. But at the same time, you had Luther Vandross singing about love. You had War singing about why can't we be friends. It was just so much stuff that made you a man, mm-hmm. made you a grown-up, made you have respect.
Yeah.
And it played a part in the hip-hop because you couldn't survive with it just being so ignorant, because you couldn't do things that you wind up being able to do later. That my bitch, she my hoe, a motherfucker. Not alone, you know. That was.
I think
not...
we've got a hit, guys. So just remember to sample that.
Yeah, that right there, that'll be a hit today.
Yeah.
Know? So again, you know, if you don't know certain things, then you don't know. It ain't your fault. So.
Right. So you guys had your first single before the album, "Dope on a Rope." Skill Trade ended up making the album. So what was Strange Family Records that put that out? Was that just you guys?
It was a company, yeah, that we formed with friend of ours, Jose De Rosario.
Yeah.
Where'd the name come from?
We was a strange man. None of us was related.
Yeah, Jose is a strange guy.
Yeah.
Where's my... That's how he talked.
Yeah, man.
And Jose used to do construction. So we'd go studios or go places. He'd pick us up in his pickup truck with paint in the back and all that. We sit outside of the back of the pickup truck. We're supposed to be going to meet. And he's like, guys, I got to make a stop. Next thing I know, we're in Long Island. He's telling us help rake up leaves in people's houses. He's doing construction and fixing the wall. I'm like, with the fucking the guns with the plaster.
Yeah.
I'm like, yo, what are you doing? Come on. I need you guys to help me.
amazing.
He's like, what is this? What kind of record company is this?
Yeah.
Strange family.
Oh, strange family. Nice.
That was a crazy time. Yeah.
You think about him, right? You're like, oh, he's ill.
Yo, dude, yeah. Where is he?
I noticed that first single was dedicated to Scott LaRock.
DJ Scott LaRock, who along with KRS-One and D-Nice were the founding members of Boogie Down Productions, was murdered on August 27th, 1987.
Not to change the mood a little bit.
Yeah.
What was your guys' relationship with him?
Scott was a good brother, man. He loved us and we loved him. He's my neighbor. He lived across the street in the building from my building.
Mm-hmm.
He seen the potential. He seen, you know, he was a guy that would speak out. And he would told Eddie O'Loughlin and them guys down the next plateau, you should sign these guys. They're going to be the next thing. They're going to be the thing, you know, like that. And he'll be going to Norby Walters, going to pick up deposits for shows because they had just did South Bronx. So... we go everywhere running around with them. They tell everybody, yo, these dudes is hot. They're going to be the joint. And well, so when we finally did it, because we had the acetate, like at the, what was that, the end of 85, going 86, when we did the plate, right? So, yeah. And we eventually, you know, got the money up with Jose and got that single pressed. And we started taking it around on Dolly. The Smooth Moms had a little Dolly you can carry your luggage on, and we would take two boxes. The boxes would be the size of this thing. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
One box, two boxes. That's it right here. And we put it on the dolly, and we get on the subway, and we'll go to 42nd Street, to Downstairs Record Shop, and then to Music Factory, because Rock and Soul and all that wasn't jumping yet, right? Nobody was really Rock and Soul. Everybody would go to Music Factory.
Exactly, yeah.
On Broadway and Times Square. Everybody would go there more. And then downstairs inside the train station.
Yeah.
And then Sam Goody and all of that, and The Wiz and all that stuff like that. So we take it, and some guys will say, hey, man, we'll take three on consignment. We're like, what the hell? So you want to open up this 50 box of records to take three
take
out?
Three. Take three. Yeah.
Yeah, and then a lot of other stores didn't want to get it if you had the box open already.
Oh, yeah. Jesus. Yeah, just playing you, man, making it very difficult.
Yeah, so we finally got rid of all of the records, and then Smooth checked his voicemail at his crib. That's when you used to have the tape, the voicemail.
Right.
Yeah.
And you hear these different people. It's like, hey, I'm calling about these records. Do you have any more records? It's like, yo, gee, they ordered more records. They want more records. He's like, word? So it got to the point where we couldn't keep manufacturing it because it started becoming a demand. So at that same time, I was already running with T down in Sleeping Bag Records and stuff. And, you know, so I got a letter of intent. They heard a demo when I was in a limo.
Mm.
And it's like, who's that on there rapping? I'm like, it's me and my boy. No, but who's the guys that's saying the words? Who's that? Me and my boy, man. We're going to do a deal with Plateau. How you going to do that? We're your family right here. This was Juggy Gales and Will Sokolov. And he said, come to the office in the morning. So he went and gave us a letter of intent, $500, and we spent that shit and never signed the contract later. Held that shit for about a year and a half, and then we signed the deal.
you got around a letter of intent. That's pretty...
Yeah, that was it. No contract. We didn't sign no contract.
So how did you guys... You had such a... Even on that first record, you had such a distinct style, right? You already had the lighthearted, kind of playful vibe.
What's your name?
I'm Teddy Ted.
My name is Greg Nice.
And I'm MC Smooth B.
Mm-hmm.
You integrated the singing.
I said, baby, listen, I'm not dissing, but I'm not one who goes around kissing each each and every woman I meet on the street.
You even on that first record, although less than you would later on, you had the echo thing.
Hey yo, Dizzy Gillespie plays a sax. Me, myself, I love to mag. Red bone booties, I'm out to wag. Stick up kids is out to tag. Spring again.
How did those elements of your style come about? Like, how did you develop a nice and smooth sound?
I think it was written, man.
Yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, it was
that's supposed to be that way.
Yeah, it was a... God. You know how you say this? Yeah, it's God, man. You know how you just say that the grand formula is like just flowing? Like, because we never, all we had to do was put our ideas together. And what emerged was what you end up hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just because I would listen to what G is saying. We're listening and sharing. We're listening to each other's ideas and just, you know, we're bouncing off each other. You know what I'm saying? And that's what makes it special, you know? And then you go, oh, yeah, that's dope. Okay, I got something. And that's how our chemistry has always been like that. Boop, boop, okay, bet. Let's put this with this. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's like the perfect meal. You know what I mean? It's like, well, we're going to add a little bit. I got some rice. Well, shit, hell yeah. You know, you know, you just keep adding on, you know.
Interesting. So you didn't even think of it as like, okay, we have a style and these are sort of the constituent parts. It just sort of...
We just being ourselves.
Came out, you know,
right.
All at once.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And people, the other little spices the universe provided, you know what I'm saying?
Because, yeah.
Oh, I'll tell you a funny one. This was crazy. This is a good one of my favorite stories too, right? So G and I kicking it. We saying, yeah, we talking about how we want to do it, how we want to integrate melodic hip hop. You know what I'm saying? Because at the same time, nobody was doing it. So we was
right.
That was part
that was
of how
something
we
that
were.
Had faded out, right? That
exactly.
was the first generation of rap groups did it.
There you go.
But by the time you came out, it had exactly. kind of gone away.
Right. And yeah. I was like, oh man, there's so much further to go with this thing. Let's rock. You know, and G already, he knew that. That's how he came up. So that's what made me excited, you know what I'm saying, to rock with G. I was like, yeah, he know what I'm talking about. Like, yeah, he gets it. Everybody else think I'm fucking speaking Martian.
Yeah.
So now here was the kicker. The day before we went in the studio. Now, years ago, we had incorporated our background singers. Like, they were called Pure Blend. You
right.
hear the guy singing on the hook, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I met them in a talent show years ago. So I used to just talk about them because they had never made a record. So at that time, I'm saying to you, yeah, man, if I could find these guys. And then the only other people we knew, you know, was the Foursome D's. So we had tried, you know, but they were touring and stuff like that. And it was like, damn, but they were down. You know what I'm saying? And G had direct numbers to them. And I was just like, damn, if we could get the Force on some of this or whatever, whatever. I said, man, if I could find these guys, man, I'm telling you, you know, right? So we're like, yeah, okay. G's like, word. Because they was mystery dudes as far as G was concerned. Like, what the hell? Okay, whatever.
Right. You knew them, but you'd lost touch or whatever.
Lost contact yeah. with them for years. You know,
yeah.
like years went by. The day before, we were scheduled to go in Power Play, do the label and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. The day before we went in, we went to a club in Midtown Manhattan. My girlfriend invited us, you know, at that time. My girl, she was like, yo, y'all come down. Because they were in a group and we were grouping. Come down to this MCA party or whatever. We go up in the party and the dudes was there. Remember that, G? And it was crazy. We were standing by the bar and I went to go to the bathroom. And just as I'm walking to the bathroom, I hear this harmony. So they're standing by the entrance of the bathroom singing, dude. And I said, oh, shit. So when I said, they was like, Smooth, where you been at? And I'm hugging them and everything. I said, yo, y'all not going to believe this. Stay right here. Do not go nowhere. They was like, all right. They stood there. I ran and got you. GG, you got to hear these. Remember what I told you about the singing motherfuckers? I said, yeah. I said, they in here. Oh, man. And the next day, we did Funky For You and We Are Number One.
Wow.
The chemistry. We just did it. It was, oh, man. That's what I'm talking about. Like how the universe just provided that.
Yeah.
The day before, you can't make that shit up.
Yeah.
You can't make that up.
Amazing. You know, the first time a lot of people heard you guys, I think, was probably on Pimpin' Ain't Easy, on the Kane track.
Yeah.
Like an apple, like a cherry, like Did you realize at the time that that was going to be like a breakthrough thing for you?
G knew. I think, you know.
I don't think that's the first time people heard us. Not at all. I think that's something that one person said,
mm-hmm.
and it got to the media. So, like, if you doing Wikipedia, doing something on us, that's what it always says in that. But I don't believe that at all, because more and more hits, and we were doing all of this stuff. We were doing the Apollo and things already.
Yeah.
We were going, doing shows every year, doing Homecoming, Syracuse, Binghamton. We were doing things already. So I think it broadened the fan base.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do anything with somebody else that got a different fan base, you're going to get some of that. That's like us doing songs with New Kids on the Block.
Right. Which you've also done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like me doing Mary J. Blige. Third base or anything, you know, you gain more. Every time you do something, you gain some more. So, but yeah, I mean, everything we did too, we did for fun. Eventually, you know, something was going to come out of it, but you had to do it for fun. Like, it's crazy too now how dudes are like, I charge you this much to be on my record. I charge you this much to be in the video. You know, that started happening, so to change a lot of the demographics of the game. But again, man, like, we just like to have fun. He was having fun. I was having fun. And you can hear it in the records and stuff. Things we talk about in the topics. We never really talk about killing your mother or selling mad dope or nothing like that.
Right.
We making riddles, man, and having fun. I was more of a riddle guy. He was more getting a message across.
It's so funny you say that, actually, because that's exactly what I wanted to talk about, because that's exactly how your biggest hit breaks down, right? That is exactly how sometimes I Rhyme Slow breaks down, where the first verse is you, Greg, kind of being more playful.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I rhyme slower, sometimes I rhyme quick. I'm sweeter and thicker than a Chico stick. Here's an ice cream cone, honey, take the lick. I'll go to Bay Plaza and catch a flick. Want my Timberland boots so I can stop the ticks.
And the second verse is Smooth, you having a little kind of a more serious message verse, you know, about the girlfriend with the drug problem and so forth.
Time went on, I started noticing weight loss. Then I had to ask her, was she riding a white horse? At first she said no. Then she said, yo, Smooth, I'm sorry, but I keep having visions of snow, I need blow. And I said, whoa, little high.
Were you worried that that was going to sound disjointed at all, to have two such different verses on the same song?
Nah. See, that's the madness of Nice and Smooth, man.
You don't worry about that. You sound good. I sound good.
Yeah, feels good. Once we sit down and listen to it.
Guys would be like, I love Smooth Beat. The lyrical thing is, then you got people be like, I love Greg Nice. He's always amped up. He's like a party. So that's what makes Nice and Smooth. I'm nice and he's smooth, you know? It ain't going to be the same thing. Like the same, we're going to get on and do the same pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the same thing.
Right.
That won't make us different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes us different.
Right. And with that song, what gave you the idea to loop Fast Car?
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere.
Was that your idea?
Yeah, and we didn't loop it. It was played.
I was going to ask, was that replayed or?
Yeah, it was played.
Okay. And,
it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, man.
It was proven that it was the right thing to do, man. You know, a whole bunch of years later, it's still a great thing. We went a lot of places with it. I have several people that always approach me about that song and tell me about what they were going through and what they were doing when that was happening.
Yeah.
So that's better than anything, because everybody think they're going to live to be 100. And that's just not the case. So every minute is precious and you got to enjoy it. I'm enjoying every second of it, man. If you can touch one person, that's amazing. You're like, this guy was thinking like I was thinking? Or they felt what I felt? That's great, man. A million people wish and pray for that to happen and never get a chance to do it for whatever reasons. And we've been fortunate enough to do it and have our freedom as far as creating and doing whatever we wanted to create. I never had to question his rhyme or whatever. I already knew what it was going to be, and vice versa. It's verses I've said that he wrote. and different things. So it's, you know, it's your spirit. My spirit will take it this way. You know, it's amazing, man. Yeah, man. It's been great. Yeah, I tell you that much.
And I wanted to ask just about No Delayin', because, you know, you sampled, I think it is actually a sample, right? Starfish and Coffee, the Prince song.
It was 7:45 on the line to put the teacher, Miss Kathleen.
With this.
Hey, yo, kicking wicked rhymes like a fortune teller. Had a dog by the name of Old Yeller. Old Yeller had a fiendish plot.
Wow, now that Prince passed away.
I was going to ask, yeah.
This is the most, I've never heard this record talked about like how it's been talked about.
Yeah.
And every interview, everything now, everything on the Twitters, everything on the Instagram, I'm like, these people ain't even know what that was.
Yeah. Did you hear? Did you hear from him after that record came out?
Not physically, you know. I didn't hear from Tracy Chapman.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear from Partridge Family. You know, but we met the people, you know,
mm-hmm.
met them, so.
Yeah, man.
You know, only person we heard from was, who was it, DeLorean's family?
Oh, yeah, DeLorean. That was funny. And sometimes when I'm slow,
mm-hmm.
so we come to the record company one day, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're feeling good, you know, hey, man, song's doing good, climbing the pop charts and shit, we starting to get better shows and. And so, I don't know, it was a lady from the publisher. Somebody, I remember just seeing somebody, the fucking letter. Yeah,
somebody at Sony told us.
Like, yeah, somebody. Yeah. They said, oh, my God.
We got a letter.
We got a letter from DeLorean. You know, his family heard the song. You know, he heard the song. His daughter, his granddaughter, whoever. Because, you know, I'm not DeLorean Gambino or Gotti.
And I said, whoa, little hottie. I'm not DeLorean Gambino or Gotti. I don't deal coke. And furthermore, you're making me broke. I'll put you in a rehab and I won't tell your folks.
Right? And they heard it. And it was just like a letter saying, like,
such and such is not a drug dealer.
Yeah, yeah, like my grandfather's not a drug dealer and all this. I was like, oh, shit. You know, I was like, okay, well listen. So
she read the letter,
got,
yeah.
It was about 30 fucking keys, 24 keys in that trunk.
John DeLorean, most famous for the car named after him that was featured in the 1985 film Back to the Future, was arrested on October 19th, 1982, and charged with conspiracy to obtain and distribute 55 pounds of cocaine. He was eventually acquitted in 1984.
Right. Now, Shorty, they'd have told you your key was something else. I don't know what they told you.
It's a house key.
But that's a whole lot of powders. And hey, I had that. You know what I'm saying? So I said, shit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, just like my dad. My granddad's not a drug dealer. I was like, oh, shit. I wanted to keep that letter, too, dude. Damn.
That is too much. The third record, you know, you have the title Jewel of the Nile, yeah. Which is a lyric on the first album.
Yeah.
Right? I think he says, Teddy Ted is the Jewel of the Nile, right?
Right.
You say that.
I'm buck wild, don't make me pull your foul. Used to wear a frown, now you wear a smile. Teddy Ted is the Jewel of the Nile. The original Ooh-child, versatile.
Yeah.
What was the significance of that phrase? Where'd that come from? Why'd you decide to reuse it for an album title?
I mean, I think at that time, we felt, when we was putting it together, we was like, this is going to be a jewel, man. You know, we recognized that our style was just, it was, of course, unique. But the energy felt really good about that album, man, and that project. And it was like, man, we're going to make this. This is going to be a jewel for y'all, man. You know, this is going to be very rare. Going to bum y'all in the head with this one, you know. And that's how I felt it.
And so it was, you know, second album was 91. This one came out in 94. Hip-hop was a very different place in 1994 than in, you know, 1990, 91. The kind of like West Coast, for lack of a better term, gangster sound had taken almost completely over. And a lot of the like lighthearted, humorous stuff had sort of fallen by the wayside a little bit. What was it like to release a Nice and Smooth album in 1994 into that kind of climate?
Ooh, I'm going to tell you something interesting, and then I know G will add on. You know, it was a trip. See, I've always felt this personally, that good music is good music, and it could exist and thrive in any climate if the people are pushing it right, like if they're consistent with it. So it was a lot of things going on internally, even with Def Jam and the promotions and getting new people and all this other stuff. And it was like, imagine if we had a set team, like we had a whole Hip Hop Junkie squad, the cats that promoted that album. Mm-hmm. So they all was locked and like, we know what y'all are doing now. We cocked and locked. And then they all got let go. So it was just a new people come in to try to, because you know, trust me, man, it's like, how can a song like, how can a song like Ice Ice Baby survive while all of us are out and everybody is making a certain incredible sound? Mm-hmm. So during these times, these different big pop records or whoever, Hammer, Can't Touch This and all of this, there was still Kool G Rap out, eating. It was so many different other people. You understand what I'm talking about? But the West Coast, it was their time, of course. But no, that song, that album, Jewel It Out, to this day, when I live in California, people say, yo, that's the first album I ever heard. That shit was incredible. It's like, so I didn't even know back then it was big in L.A. We had no idea. But again, the infrastructure had fell from under, you know, beneath us. So... But it felt good personally because we didn't feel no threat. We knew our follow-up was going to be strong. And the way that, you know, we could judge that climate. We was like, this shit is going to be sick. Once they, because they, in other words, it was proven. Before we came out with a record, we had to prove that what we were talking about was valid. And then, so by your third, people know, and when you listen to those songs, that's a tight-ass album. And by that time, we had already had so many connections with West Coast. We developed a West Coast following. So we knew that it would be embraced over there. You dig what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All we needed was that initial extra promotion and push. So a lot of people didn't hear it. A lot of people don't even know that album exists. Mm-hmm. But then a lot of people do.
Yeah.
Surprisingly to me. I was like, oh, you know that shit? And I'm like, dude, we know. I ran into a girl that heard the song Sherry in Africa. I said, I shit in Africa? The girl, I'm in Japan. Japanese girl tells me that she went to Africa. I think she was in Ghana or something. And was in it was Ghana. And she said she was in a club or a bar. And the song Sherry, which was never released as a single, was on the jukebox.
And Sherry, I can't wait.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
He said, yeah, I heard it in Africa. I'm like, damn. So, you know,
With all that said, were you disappointed when it came out and didn't sell as well as the previous two?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know what I'm saying? But then this crazy part, like over these years, and I guess with this new, the internet, whatever, it picked up, the sales picked back up. So I was like, damn, it's real, you know. But the expectations and the vision for it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So when it didn't, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Nah, man, you won't waste our shit. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
But it just was what it was.
Yeah. And, you know, on Mad Love, mm-hmm. you have a line that I didn't quite understand. Maybe you could help me with it. You compare Whip-A-Whip and Dada Rock
yeah.
to Salt-N-Pepa.
I beat the go-getter, true high-stepper. Whip-A-Whip and Dada Rock used to be Salt-N-Pepa.
Okay, let me give you
say that. They're kind of like the older versions of Salt-N-Pepa.
Well,
so.
Let me give you an example. Let me break that down to you. Whip-A-Whip and Dada Rock, because of their complexions, light skin and dark skin, they were originally Salt-N-Pepa. They used to call them the Salt-N-Pepa MCs.
Whip-A-Whip, what's your sign and what's your name? What's on your mind?
I'm fresh, I'm a cool Sagittarian with clientele. And if you ask me my name, I'll just say, well, I'm Prince Whip-A-Whip. And yes, I want to stay now. The professor, new magician of the microphone. And that's it, you want to know why?
James, Prince Whip-A-Whip Whipper, and Daryl Dada Rock Mason would go on to greater fame as members of the Fantastic Romantic Five.
That they called them Salt-N-Pepa.
Oh.
And only people that's really into hip-hop and in New York, you know that. So when I said Whippa Whip and Dr. Rock used to be Salt and Pepper. They were the original Salt and Pepper. Mm. And so, but I had to give them that. You know what I'm saying? Because can you imagine? I can't even imagine how they might have felt. Like, damn, Salt and Pepper, and they get them places with girls, man. And they blew the fuck up. And we ain't never made a record. You know what I'm saying? Like, damn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, damn. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I thought about that. And I just wanted them. It came to me. And at that moment, I said, I'm going to tell them that somebody of our era
remembers.
Knew, right. Yeah. Knew that they were Salt and Pepper. Wow. And Dr. Rock, peace and bless, he passed away. But I saw him on 183rd, like right after the tour. He was like, y'all heard that, man? That was incredible, man. Thank you. I was like,
wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. And, you know, on Blunts, you guys have a shout out to Showbiz and AG.
Pass another blunt like a bat. Like Showbiz, I like my pockets fat, not flat.
Right, you quote the pockets fat.
I like my pockets fat, not flat. I like my pockets fat, not flat.
Which got me thinking, like, what were your feelings about the DITC guys?
The Diggin' in the Crates crew, also known as DITC, was the predominantly Bronx-based crew made up of Big L, Lord Finesse, Diamond D, OC, Fat Joe, Buck Wild, Showbiz, and AG. Check our archives for episodes with AG and OC and Fat Joe.
They were from the Bronx. They came out after you guys were already stars, already had hits. Was there like a sense of competition? Was there friendship? How did you view the DITC crew?
I don't know nobody in that time and era like that felt like competition. Not with us. We were like kind of like the superheroes of the neighborhood. And we kept it, you know, in the neighborhood. You would see me on Fordham Road standing outside all day, Smooth on Fordham, on Webster. We on 125th standing on the corner, right here on 118th, down 116th. On Lennox, wherever, we was just always there. We hanging at the weed spot. We up at Branson's. We everywhere, God, you know. We was in projects, so we was just there. You know, we'd be there.
Shout out to Branson, by the way. Yeah. Love Branson.
Yeah. Yeah. Then the next morning, we on Soul Train.
Right.
Then we get on the plane, come back home, and we right there. The next week, we on Living Color, you know.
Yeah.
And still be right, you know, so that's what it was about. You know, a lot of the guys, like Fat Joe and all of them used to take them to shows with us and things like that. So, man. It was, man. Even, like, I'll be in Brooklyn, man. I know Big Daddy Kane before Big Daddy Kane ever came out, you know?
Mm.
He would be on the bus with me and T. LaRock and all of us, and he would be there DJing for Roxanne Shanté. And his homeboy be hanging out with him, Mr. C. And I remember T and us. Me and T had an extra room. We gave C a room on the road because he was just Kane's boy, you know, hanging out. And so all of that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah, it seems like you guys.
New York was bonded.
Right.
New York was bonded. And it wasn't like, you know, no gang thing, blood and Crip and all that kind of stuff. That was a whole different thing going on somewhere else in another state. But New York was like, you know. You wear whatever color you want to wear. The last of the gang stuff went out in the 70s, and that was a different type of gang issue. So everything was about love, you know. You got some dudes that be battling each other in rap, but it was never nothing serious. Like, you'd be like, I want to hurt that person, or I hate that dude. You know, everybody was happy.
Mm-hmm. That actually reminds me of something I wanted to ask about, going back to the Bobby Brown days for a second. I read somewhere that Busta Rhymes was hanging out with you guys during the Bobby Brown days, and you actually introduced them to each other.
Yeah.
Which is just a funny image, a little teenage Busta Rhymes, hyped up Busta Rhymes hanging out with Bobby Brown.
Yeah. Oh, we took him to his house. Yeah, it was crazy down in Atlanta. And he was tripping. He was like, yo! He just went crazy. He went into his leader's bus joint. Like, I mean, this was like, it was his first time up in a crazy mansion, like, and then at the same time, it's hitting him in this Bobby, and he was like, he literally starts going to be like, ah! And Bob was like, all right, come on. It's all right. Come on in, man. Come on in. We bugging. Come on in. He just was like, yo, listen. You know, Buster, he had less of a filter, you know, back then. He was young, and he was hype, and he just let your ass know that he was having a good time.
Right.
One time we were in the car, Greg is like synonymous, and he's the... Greg was like the, he was like the, I don't know. He would scoop motherfuckers up from wherever they were and just bring them around. I'd be like, where you meet this crazy motherfucker at? Nah, Smiles, just a cool little nigga, right? You know, he'd go all out to Long Island or Staten Island.
Yeah, go to Long Island, pick him up.
Yep, go get Busta Rhymes.
And, right here, we'll go to 16th Street and get pizza.
Yeah.
You know? Lexington. It used to be a pizza shop on the corner right there. I remember the pizza burnt his mouth.
Oh, man. Let me tell you something. True story. We did No Delaying.
Mm-hmm.
Let me snatch Busta up. Actually, when I met Greg, Greg pulled up. He got Busta in the car with him. In the car. We played. No one had heard No Delaying. We played No Delaying with Busta.
You know what I'm saying? When I'm on the mic, they're walking without delaying. When I'm on the mic, they're walking
without delaying. Smooth beat. My mom's express awareness. And I possess finesse and we share this.
First person to hear it.
Yeah.
Wow.
He lost his brain so crazy, he grabbed his hair and he was zoning like this. And when he finished, he had his dreads in his hand.
That was on the Damn Thing Change album.
Oh, that was the Damn Thing Change when he bugged out?
Yeah, yeah, it was in the Damn Thing Change.
Oh, my bad. I'm saying, yeah.
The whole album.
He loved No Delaying.
He was at home in Long Island.
Oh, okay.
He was still like, you know, a fan.
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah. It was the Damn Thing. He pulled. When he finished,
pulled his dreads out.
He pulled his dreads out. We was just like, take it easy, Pop.
He was hype. He was hype.
He was so, yeah, man. Funny, man. Great time.
Wow. And so speaking of the second album, right? I was watching old Yo MTV Raps, and you guys kind of let it slip on air that album came in under budget.
Yo, wait, G. I heard on the down low, on the production tip, you brothers brought your album in for like mad under budget.
Straight
like,
up and down.
Like... what a lot of people spend just to remix a record, you put your whole album in.
Straight up.
And I was wondering just if you ever heard from anyone at the record company about that or anything like that. I thought it was just kind of a funny little like tidbit to let slip out.
I never had myself. I don't remember no repercussions from. That was the plan always down, you know, to keep it under budget.
Mm.
That's a good question.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's something I noticed there. So you guys have been obviously group for 30 years now, right?
Yeah,
since 86. With this long, what have you come to like and what are some things you've maybe grown not to like about the format of a duo specifically? Like, is that ever frustrating or?
Shaq and Kobe.
Yeah.
And on that Ain't a Damn Thing Changed album, which I think was 91, buried in the thank yous there is a thank you to Puff Daddy, who at that time was at Uptown, I think, right? What was your relationship with him? Because that was the very beginning of his career.
It was that type of thing. He was just trying to... What I saw in him was just a hungry dude that wanted to win, but I felt he had a good heart. And we know so many people. We saw so many people come into the game. So when he was trying to do his promotions, you know, and club promotions and all that, he would always come to us. Mm-hmm. Yo, man, would y'all do this for me, man? Because we were hot. We're like, when we was hot, we give him that love, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Because we could see he was putting in work and he was trying. You know what I'm saying? Like, all right, we'll do it. Let me show him love. You know what I'm saying? And it was like, we was cool. You know, everybody was rocking together. You know what I mean? And so I seen him. We seen him a few times and seen him through some struggles. And sometimes I would run into him and he'd tell me different things about what he was trying to do. And the actual quote is, Puff Daddy, you will excel. That's what I wrote. Puff Daddy, you will excel. Because I knew he was going to be
that.
You
knew he had that kind of drive.
Yeah. And I wanted him to see that so he could say, so he would get that inspiration. Because before you get from here to there, you know what I'm saying? There's a lot going on in between.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, let me try to get this dude some inspiration here, man. Because I know you're going through some shit.
When that was after the basketball game you wrote that?
That was before.
Do you guys remember, were you around when that happened at all? Or
The basketball game?
We
were in it.
Yeah.
On December 28th, 1991, Heavy D and a then largely unknown Puff Daddy put on the Heavy D and Puff Daddy Celebrity Charity Basketball Game, a fundraising event for AIDS charities at City College of New York. The event was supposed to feature Heavy, Run DMC, Big Daddy Kane, Ed Lover, Jodeci, Boyz II Men, and Michael Bivins of Belle Biv DeVoe. A huge crowd, hundreds more than the gym could hold, gathered outside. The waiting crowd surged past security and into the building. To quote the History Channel's look back at the tragedy, once inside the lobby, the crowd rushed down a short set of stairs leading to the gymnasium. At the bottom of these stairs, however, were four swinging doors, three of them closed, that opened not into the gymnasium but into the stairwell. While the 3,000-strong crowd surged forward obliviously, those people who reached the stairwell first were caught in a crush that would leave 8 dead on the scene and 29 others injured, one of whom would die later of her injuries at St. Luke's Hospital. Legal wranglings over the incident continued until 2000, when Puff Daddy would settle the last of the lawsuits brought by one of the people injured at the game.
We lost friends. We left to go to the basketball game with friends and didn't leave with them.
Yeah, three of them.
Three of our friends died.
From my house. They all left my house with me.
Yeah. Yeah. We almost died. We were in the stairwell.
Hell yeah. I was in there screaming, crying.
Shit was crazy.
This is how I'm going to die. This is how I'm going to die. People getting smashed so much that your feet were not on the ground anymore. People pissing and shitting on themselves.
I lost a friend from the fourth grade, man.
That shit was no joke.
Crazy.
That shit scared the shit out of me. It made me fear being in large crowds. Like if I see something crowded or whatever, I don't fuck with
it. Even now?
I get away. Hell yeah. I get to the side. I stay wherever the door is at. I don't need this. If you don't respect life, man, it's easy to die in there. That's like when you're in school and they teach you how to go through a fire drill. You know, Everybody can't fit in that door once. Single file line. Going crazy. You just trying to get out.
Right.
Everybody gets stuck like Happy Lands in the Bronx.
Which is another. Yeah, that was.
On March 25th, 1990, a man named Julio Gonzalez set fire to an unlicensed social club named Happy Land in the Bronx, where his ex-girlfriend was working. 87 people, mostly ethnic Hondurans celebrating Carnival, died in the fire. The death toll was so high because the club's fire exits were blocked in order to prevent people from entering without paying the cover charge.
That was the same shit that happened in the city college. Like, and I remember it because I was only about 4 steps away from the last door. So I don't know if you know how the gym is made. You go down one set of staircase, boom, it's a platform, then doom, 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 another set of stairs, and then doom, 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 to the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And in between the basement is like that much space from that counter and that black thing, and that's the doors. So those cabinets are the doors. And only one door is open. There's 4 cabinets, 4 doors. That one is closed, that one is closed, that one is closed. The one to the left is open. And Puff and Jessica, Rosenblum, all of them, they were sitting on the other side of the table,
right,
taking the tickets.
Right.
And everything was cool. And then people started pushing from outside on Convent Avenue, pushing. Now you're pushing all the way. Now you're pushing people that's in the hallway, in the staircase. They don't realize that the doors is not open, and you're smashing people. And I started feeling it get tight. I was like, and I'm trying to turn around like, I want to get out. Now you can't leave. I'm like, oh, shit. Oh, no. And then it got tight where I couldn't do this no more. That's when I'm like,
literally couldn't move.
Right.
Nerves and start crying. I'm like, this is how I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to get my arms up so I can get my arms out of my jacket. But there's other people smashing you on this side.
Right.
Then some people are falling. Because after a while, they couldn't stand no more. So people just start giving up. And just, if you fall under, you know, people will just stand on top of you. And that was it. And I crawled into that shit like this. Some guy was under me. He was like, Greg Nice, I'm going to push you up. And he's pushing me. And I got up. And this is, I'm crawling on top of people. Crawled through the doorway and puffing them on the other side. He's screaming and crying. Trying to pull people through.
Wow.
Boom. Head first on the damn wooden floor in the gymnasium. People on the bleachers, the game. I remember Dougie was on the mic. It's Uptown in the house. Everybody in there crowded. They don't even know. Say we looking like that, and that's the door. This the gym. But nobody even
had no idea.
The door. Then they looking, they seeing myself and other people. And there's one person like, oh no. You see, I hear people scream. Everybody jumped off the bleachers and tried to go to the doors to, like, get the doors open. And the fucking handle was on the wrong side. You know, it's supposed to be like you can push it on this way,
yeah.
Or you can push it in that way. So I think that's why people had that lawsuit against the school, because they had a fire hazard.
Right. What was the aftermath of that like for you, for the people who were involved in performing there?
I don't know. I ran in the back because I needed air.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be around people, a lot of people. I wanted to get air because it seemed like it was going to get crowded again. So found a bathroom in the back and about 8 other people in the bathroom. And this other guy I know, Hev, he was a security guy to be at the clubs and stuff. He had a damn pistol and shit, and he pulled his pistol out. And all of us was in the bathroom, and he was just by the door way so nobody could come in. Every time he's like, get up! Because everybody's trying to run. He's like, nobody coming in here.
Yeah.
We like, we got to breathe. I'm standing on the stall of the toilet. And it's, what's the name? What you call those? The ceilings that you can push it up?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like that?
Yeah.
And, you know, you see pipes and all that. So all right. of that is cool up there. So I'm pushing that shit up and I'm standing on the water thing, on the toilet, pressing it. So you can keep getting water, air coming out. About 30 minutes later, you start hearing walkie-talkies and shit. And you notice that it was the fire department's coming through and the police. And that's when we open the door. You see everybody coming through and running back and forth. Then we go out back to the main gym floor, looking around. So you see sheets and stuff. You're like, what the fuck is that? What is that? And you're like, you're lifting sheets up as bodies and things. So, oh, shit. Oh, shit. My boy Spice, that do security with us. I see him. I'm like, and I can remember going, yo, G, you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm okay, man. He's like, you sure? Because he's behind me. And I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. Seeing the 17-year-old kid that came with my other buddy. He was just dying to meet me. And I told him, bring him to my house. And the song we had, the Wick song, was like the number one song in the whole country.
Right.
Everybody going, every car go by, everything. Boom. So I was like, bring the kid. And let him, he can come to my house. And then I was like, I got to go to this game with my boy Puff. He's doing this party, this celebrity game, him and Hev. Because everywhere we go then, Puff used to be with us everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere we used to hang, he used to hang. And seeing that kid laying there. Seeing Smooth Buddy from his church was laying there. And you seeing their cars and stuff when you're leaving, because we all came. You see where their cars parked, like, oh shit, this shit is real.
Yeah.
Yeah, from that, like, we was doing some big ass show in North Carolina and it was ready for us to come to the stage, but you had to go through the crowd. And I was like, ugh. I walked in, I walked back into the dressing room. I was like, I can't do it. And they had to find a way to open up the crowd, and then I came through that way and did it because I was like, my nerves was toe up for a long time.
I believe it.
That's like we go downstairs to the lobby of this building and all of the people from this Frederick Douglass was pushing to get in.
Right, to get in.
And
that
one space and nowhere else to get out.
Right.
Like sardines. That shit was terrifying.
So I know, Greg, you were very close to Pac toward the last month of his life or so. You actually lived with him. But before that, when did you first meet him? Was it in the Digital Underground days?
I guess like right before that. Yeah, right before that. He always was the same individual. He never...
Was he living in New York at that point or where...
I don't know if he was living here. Maybe his family was here.
Mm-hmm.
I know he's going bi-coastal. Because, you know, I know his mom was telling me that. You know, we lived on Woody Crest. You lived in Nelson. That's one street over from each other. I'm like, oh, snap.
Yeah.
So we start building on that.
So you met him even before his days with Shock G and them?
Right when
that was starting?
Right when it was popping off. Yeah,
wow.
Right when it started. And then I seen him again when Juice came. I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time I seen him, like, yo. And he's like, what you doing, man? Where you going? I'm going with you. And he told Shock, yo, I'm out. I'm going with him. And jumped in my car and we just broke out. We was rolling for 2 days.
Yeah. And, you know, so when you hooked up with him again toward the end of his life, what was his mind state like? What was he doing? What were his plans? Like, stuff like that.
He had seemed basically like he's like, I'm trying to be more family orientated. I ain't fucking with this person. I ain't fucking motherfuckers like that. I'm just keeping all my relatives around and keeping it in the family. That's how I'm going to do my thing now. And I'm going to start my own company and I want to sign you and you know how Smooth doing. I'm like, he all right? He's like, I just want to know because I love him like I love you. Let's get started. Let's do your single tonight. Let me do the hook. We're going to bug the world out. And like I said, he was keeping it close-knit, like with his aunt and his mom. And they come every week to his crib. And that's what he was doing, cooking stuff in the kitchen and you know, I guess he was like, you know, he was tired of a lot of the bullshit. And he said, I want to go to New York. He's like, I miss New York. He's like, I know everybody mad at me. He's like, I can't hurt nobody. Look at me. Look how small I am. I can't hurt nobody. And that's when we started trying to get this One Nation thing together. and that was it.
I guess that, you know, it's worth asking, since she passed not long ago, how well did you know Afeni? Did you get to spend time with her?
Yeah, definitely did. Mm-hmm.
What was she like?
She was a nice woman. She never stole nothing wrong on me. Everything I experienced with her, she was always nice. You know, from sitting in the kitchen at the house with him, from when we went down and stayed with her at the crib after he passed away and did a memorial for him and stuff.
Wow. When was this? Was it just after he passed? Or?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, Smooth, I wanted to ask you, so on Do What You Gotta, you have a line about, you know, always never leave the house without reading my Psalms.
Yeah.
This style deals with the mic in the palm. I never leave my crib without reading the Psalms. I gotta read my scriptures for they keep me refined. I gotta keep my nine for the deaf, dumb, and blind. Rewind,
so and, you know, I've seen you in interviews talk about how, you know, you always have a Bible, or at the point of this interview, which is probably the early 90s, always had a Bible with you and stuff like that. is religion still an important part of your life?
Absolutely. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I always like to, I mean, I think about God all the time. You know what I'm saying? That's the first thought on my mind and the last thought before I lay down, you know. But, yeah, you know, you grow, you know what I'm saying? And you start to realize that we all are one and that God is not far from you. In fact, he's right inside of you, in all of us. And we all are seeing different aspects of God when we interact. You know what I'm saying? So, that's like, but I like to refresh and pick up scripture. And I've always been the type of person, I guess people maybe call me a street preacher. Like, you know, I'm not the orthodox, you know, the, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm the read it, see how it applies to me personally, develop my own relationship with God, and try to find what's going on in the scripture out here. Make it apply to what I'm dealing with every day. Like, oh, okay. You know what I'm saying? And that's the balance for me.
And was it odd being, I guess, Christian? You're Christian or?
I'm not one title. I'm a universal spirit.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
So okay.
I mean, shit, you might see me up in a synagogue, in a church, a mosque. I pop up everywhere.
Okay. So I was going to ask, because the time you guys came out, the sort of de facto religion of hip hop wasn't anything resembling Christian. It was, if anything, you know, some version of Islamic or related to the Nation of Islam or the Absolutely. Gods on Earth or whatever.
Right.
So
absolutely. And see, here's the thing about growing up in New York, especially in the era and time when we did. You know, when I grew up, my older brothers, I'm the youngest, so two of my brothers used to run with they called them the first nine born. These were the first nine students of Clarence 13X, of the 5%
wow.
Nation. Yeah. So they used to run with the first nine born. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, you see it growing up. Like, I was around all of that. So it's just like, oh, okay, what you talking about? You know what I mean? They'd have ciphers in my crib. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, oh, all right, this is interesting, you know? And then my mom would take me to church. But at the end of the day, you know, it was just like, know that God is real and find out how that relates to you. My mama slapped me in my head. She take me to church. Then I come out of church and my brothers call the pastor a pimp. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, huh? He got a Cadillac and diamond rings. He ain't nothing but a pimp. You know, and my mom's just like, don't be telling that boy that shit. You know, and I'll be like, damn, for real? He did look like a pimp, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, in my little mind, I'm like, I seen him looking at that lady behind. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's just crazy.
You know, taking everything in all sides at that point.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And then it was like, back then, growing up, in your building, look, in my one building, I had Filipino neighbors, Puerto Rican neighbors, Dominican neighbors, and Jewish. You understand? So in the different holidays, when it's Passover and all that, I'm up in the Jewish family house though,
right,
eating matzahs and shit. Yeah, I'm learning. I'm like, this bread is kind of good. Put some more butter on that. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? So I'm messing with the matzahs.
Yeah.
We all in school together. The Filipino got me coming over there eating certain dishes, and then on the holidays they come into our house. You know what I'm saying? So it was the melting pot mentality.
Mm.
And so I'm learning, I'm picking up. And what I can relate to, I'm like, yo, I like that, though. That applies. And then as your life continues, you start, you continually see it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's me. I'm universal spirit, though.
Interesting. Yeah. And I know that that slips into your lyrics every once in a while.
Yeah.
You know, you drop a little bit in here.
Yeah,
and
I'm
there.
Talking about lotus flowers and shit. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Lotus flower.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, since we're, I don't know, 10 blocks south or so of the Allah School in Mecca, I guess, Greg, do you have any relationship with the gods? I know they were big in the Bronx, probably.
We got relationships with everybody, man.
Yeah.
From me going to a Catholic school, from me having a Jewish manager, Jewish record execs, from me sitting down having dinner at Minister Louis Farrakhan's house, from sitting there talking with Ben Chavis, seeing Dick Gregory, buddies in the Israelites. Mm. Who designed our first outfits on our first album cover.
Oh, really? Those yeah. Black Israelites who designed that
yeah.
stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So
it's like I said earlier, man, it's supposed to be universal.
Right.
You know? And you're supposed to expand and like the crayon box. You got all different flavors.
Yeah.
And it's good to know about all of these different things that studies people's religions and cultures. And I mean, why just stay stagnated on one thing?
Mm-hmm. Great.
This shit ain't promised. Like I said, it's short-lived. It's moving extremely fast, man. Prince is gone.
Man.
Michael Jackson gone. James Brown gone. People gone. Things that you would never imagine because they seemed immortal. To the point where somebody would say, excuse me, mister. And I'm looking around for who the fuck they talking to. And they talking to me. I'm like, mister?
Yeah.
In my mind, I'm still 17.
Right. The 17-year-old beatboxing kid.
Man,
yeah.
Going in, you know.
No beatboxing on Nice and Smooth records, though. There's like one song. You Why know, not?
Because it's in the concerts.
Ah.
Yeah.
Which leads me to my next thing. Just kind of wanted to wind down by asking you guys about the 30th anniversary tour you're on now. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, man. It's just a beautiful thing, man. It's like, damn, man. You know? Ah, man, this is like a breath of fresh air. Like, it's like a dose of life again, like a boost. Give a car a jump, like, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, I mean, I'm just so looking forward to it. It's like a gift, giving that good energy back to our peoples. You know what I'm saying? All our fans and letting them, you know what I'm saying? And then at the same time, it's groundbreaking. You know what I'm saying? Because we're taking that initiative to get out there and put that work in, you know what I'm saying? So it's a beautiful opportunity. And I'm like, damn, man. Like, even doing this interview and covering so much of our careers and lives, man, it's a beautiful thing, man. I just feel good, man.
Thank you. Greg, anything you want to tell people about the tour?
I want them to come out and see it because if you never had an opportunity to check us out live, I believe you're missing something, especially if you're into hip-hop. Or if you're into music and being entertained, it's something that you missed. And for those who, you know, just become of age and want to know about our time after listening to this interview, you know, go get your tickets at therealniceandsmooth.com or niceandsmooth@eventbrite.com. And the tickets are reasonable. We're not charging you a lot of money. You can get a meet and greet. And it's going to be a great time. And leave the knives and the guns at home because we don't do that where we play at. We love to have a good time and enjoy life. Come on out, rock with Nice and Smooth, and learn about us. Today you got your tools, you got your YouTubes and all this other stuff where you can get information at. So come on out and have a good time. I want to bridge the gap with the youth and the elder in the game.
Yeah.
So come on out, y'all.
And one final question before you go. I have to ask, what does... No matter how many times the ball bounces, there's still no bones in ice cream.
I got 93 flavors. Work for days, I got 93 flavors. No matter how many times.
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 No matter how many times the ball bounces, there's still no bones in ice cream. No matter
what on earth does that mean?
I don't know. Tell me what panda mean. I'm just messing around with you. I'm just messing around with you. I don't know.
Yeah.
Where did that hook come from? Was that an expression or was that just something you guys made up?
It was an expression from a friend of ours. You can tell him his name's Smooth.
Bismarck.
Oh.
Yeah, man.
That was something he said?
Yeah, like he'd give these analogies, right? And this was so crazy. So we like, in other words, the actual ball bounces and bones and ice cream, that we threw right in. But he'd say, like, an analogy, like, let's say, no matter how many times I break this glass with a hammer, we still going to end up on the east side if we keep walking this way. You know what I'm saying? Something like that. You know what I'm saying?
So
like,
it was the idea of these things that didn't make any sense.
Right. He put them both together, but both of them are reality. You know what I'm saying? Like, so we just start playing around. I said, yeah, look, this motherfucker's crazy. This is crazy. We do it all day. Like, he just keep going, yo, well, and no matter, and he just go into it and I'd be like, yo, and no matter how many times you remember this hammer, then it's up, 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 and I was like, yo, this motherfucker crazy. So I was like, he said something one time and then it stuck in my head. And I said, oh, that's kind of crazy, something about bouncing the ball or something. So I said, well, no matter how many times the ball bounces, there's still no bones and ice cream.
Nice.
Because there's no bones and ice cream, baby. So if you keep bouncing that ball, you can bounce it from now to 2050.
Right.
There'll never be bones and ice cream.
All right. Well, thank you guys, Nice and Smooth, for coming out and hanging with us.
Much love.
Thank you for bringing us up to Harlem to do an interview.
Of course.
Would have never thought that this was going to happen.
Right.
This is amazing. Peace to all of the homies on Manhattan Ave and on A5 and 7 for Lennox. Benny Ratt, rest in peace.
Man, Benny Ratt, wow.
116th, 117th.
Mm-hmm.
When I first sat down with Greg Nice and Smooth B, I expected to get insight into their music and maybe a funny Bobby Brown story or two. What I did not expect was a horrific blow-by-blow account of the tragic CCNY basketball game. That segment was one of the most emotionally intense in the history of the podcast. But in addition to that story, there was so much history about the Bronx, about the early days of hip-hop, and about the process of rap music moving into popular culture in what Nice and Smooth had to say. For a group that is often lighthearted, funny, and a little bit silly, they certainly can teach us all quite a bit. As I mentioned at the top of the show, here's how you can find a little bit extra from today's interview. Anyone who becomes a Patreon supporter by noon Eastern time on
Friday, June 10th, 2016,
will get a special bonus story from Smooth B that we recorded after the end of this interview. It's all about how he learned the secret history of hip-hop fashion icon Dapper Dan. Again, you can sign up at patreon.com/thecyphershow and contribute as little as $1 a month by noon Eastern on
Friday, June 10th,
to hear this bonus story. Join us next week when our guest will be Ms. Jade. The Philly rapper exploded onto the scene as a protege of Timbaland and Missy Elliott in the early 2000s. Since then, she's had her fair share of ups and downs and has come back making better music than ever. You'll hear all about her journey, from working with Jay-Z and Missy, to putting out mixtapes with DJ Drama right before his whole operation ran into some pretty serious trouble, to her recent freestyle series and her upcoming album, Beautiful Mess. Make sure to tune in. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program and help us out with as little as $1 a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything relating to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I stand on looking at that lady behind.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Boop, boop. Okay, bet. Let's put this with this.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
In the daytime, the heat was there, so it would have melted the vinyl.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Y'all heard that, man? That was incredible, man. Thank you.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jay.
They will kick the bottom of the light pole and stick a fuse in a light pole, an adapter, and plug the cord into it, and that's how they got the power.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
You don't have to be quiet. You have to be quiet. But you don't have to be quiet.
You have to be quiet, but shut up.